Welcome to the WCHL Community Forum, presented by the Town of Chapel Hill Economic Development at Durham Technical Community College. Our monthly forum features Chapel Borough's elected officials and community leaders debating topics affecting our community and you. The discussion is sponsored by the Town of Chapel Hill Economic Development. Chapel Hill is open to business and for business. More at opentobusiness.biz and by Durham Technical Community College, Durham and Orange County campuses. Do great things. The WCHL Community Forum begins now.
And welcome into the WCHL Community Forum here for the month of January, looking at 2018. And we have got Representative Greg Meyer in with us to talk about issues going on at the state level and also to hopefully give us a little bit of a reset. I know that we've got a lot of moving parts with different cases on different levels of gerrymandering and partisan and racial gerrymandering and congressional seats and state level seats and whether we're going to have judicial primaries. And that's all in the next couple of months. And then we've got several bits of 2018 other items to talk about. So first off, thank you for coming in and hanging out with us for today.
I'm always glad to be at WCHL and so ready to dive in.
You are the recruitment chair for the Democrats in the House.
Correct, yes.
So y'all have had several Blue Mondays, as you've called it, looking at an unveiling of a slate of candidates, kind of all coming one after another. We've got state districts that are still being sorted out, but as of right now, the federal courts have adopted the special masters redistricting map versus what the Republicans drew in their second attempt at trying to get one that the court would agree to here. So can you just take us back to setting the groundwork for where we're starting 2018 from, kind of
sure,
on that front in the House?
Sure. In both the North Carolina House and Senate, we will have new maps for the 2018 elections. No matter what happens with the rest of the court case, there are going to be new maps. Mm-hmm. In Orange County, that does not impact Senator Fauci. Her district is actually remaining the same in the new maps, but Representative Insko and I are swapping some precincts. So I'm picking up Hillsborough. She's picking up my precincts in Chapel Hill. I lose my Durham County precincts. I pick up Caswell County. So some voters here need to figure out who they're voting for. Across the state, there will be changes in about two-thirds of districts. This is all due to the 2011 maps being found to be unconstitutional racial gerrymanders. The legislature drew new maps. The Republicans jammed those through. And so those maps were then found to be inadequate by a court, which ordered a set of changes to those. That's what we call the special master maps. The special master's maps are currently on appeal to the Supreme Court of the United States. We think that the Supreme Court will uphold the lower court's decision and that the special master's maps will be the maps that we're going to run on. But even if the Supreme Court does not uphold those maps, we will be running on the maps that were redrawn in 2017. And so there's going to be new maps one way or another.
And the Supreme Court, I believe the deadline is February 2nd for that as we're recording this on February 1st. That would be tomorrow, but it will air kind of after that deadline is
passed.
Yeah,
I guess our filing for election starts on February 12th, so that's probably the drop-dead deadline.
Which I assume makes it a little bit of a challenge with trying to get things organized and ready to go by that filing deadline. And then we'll have, of course, primaries and then the elections in the fall. So as the recruitment chair for House Democrats, what has your message been to prospective candidates and how has that been received over the last year as we've talked about some more intensity in terms of interest in some cases from something that may be going on at the federal level or if it's state level stuff?
We're going to have more candidates running for legislative races than we've had in several years. I can guarantee that. I think we've got a really good chance of actually having somebody in just about every single race across the state, which doesn't happen because there's some districts where you'd have to be crazy to run. The district is so hard to win in. But there's several things that are making a difference this year. One is that we were able to tell people we're going to have new maps. And in a lot of areas in the states, these maps will make it easier for a Democrat to win. But the bigger difference is that people are just really fired up. There are a lot of people who are stepping up to run who previously wouldn't have. And so that enthusiasm is what's making it easier to recruit. And what we're hoping is that that enthusiasm will also lead to greater voter turnout. And so that's really the third item in recruiting people is saying, look, this could be a wave year election. This could be the type of thing that happens in an off year election where the pendulum swings dramatically the other way. And if that's true, we want you to run. We want you to be ready to stand in one of those, stand up and speak in one of those districts where the wave might come your way and sweep you into office.
And the wave being interesting here because I guess the last one was 2010 with the Tea Party wave that came through, and that was an especially consequential election. It was the off year, it was the midterm election, but it was also directly before redrawing new maps where we've seen drastic changes in state houses across the country and in Congress. So what does a wave year look like in North Carolina?
Well, 2010 was also the first off-year election of a new president's term, just like this year will be. But this is an even more special year. This is what we call a blue moon election in North Carolina because once every 12 years, we have an election where there is no senator or governor or president on the ballot. So the only statewide races are the Supreme Court race and a couple of other appellate races, a couple of other judicial races. And so without major statewide campaigns, congressional and legislative races are really the kind of leading things in any local area. And in those years, because there's not that interest in the top of the ticket, turnout tends to be down 50 to 60%. What that means is that if turnout down that far, whichever party has more enthusiasm and is able to reduce their turnout the least is the one that's going to be the most likely to pick up a wave. So, you know, if I'm talking to a candidate and I say, yeah, look, the Democrat in your district last time lost by 8 points. Mm-hmm. But in this election, if the Republican turnout falls 50% the way that it usually does, but you're able to get this energized group of Democrats who are fired up about Trump, and you're able to keep the Democratic turnout to only falling 40%, you're going to win. That's going to be the difference. And that doesn't require you to convince a single Trump voter to change their mind and come vote for you. You can go do that too, but you can win just by convincing people that voted for Hillary Clinton and Roy Cooper to come out and vote for you because they want you to support the governor's agenda.
And from a numbers perspective, the House and Senate both have Republican supermajorities, which means Roy Cooper can veto anything that he would like, but the votes are there whenever the full assembly is met from each chamber that they can overturn any veto. So from a supermajority standpoint, what are y'all hoping for? What do y'all need to be able to move past those?
We need to elect four additional Democrats in the House to break the Republican supermajority. Because the North Carolina Constitution really weights power towards the legislature, mm-hmm. Governor Cooper is very limited in terms of what he can do around his policy agenda. And if we're able to sustain a veto, then Governor Cooper all of a sudden has lots more leverage to use in trying to lead the state. The most important veto every year, of course, being – well, not every year, but when it happens, the most important veto that would happen of a Republican-led legislature over a Democratic governor is going to be on the budget. And so if Governor Cooper can veto a Republican budget and we can sustain that veto, then we can negotiate for some things that we want in the budget, like higher pay for teachers or greater investments in healthcare, in a way that we're just not able to do when Republicans hold a supermajority.
So what has it been like? You mentioned we're talking about Cooper here for a moment. He's definitely got the two more years before being up for election again. So you've got this year that's going to be played out with the members that are there now. We're not having those elections that thought we might have in 2017 to bring about the special election for everybody in the House and Senate. So you've got another year with the makeup of the R's and D's being what it is, with the Democrat in the governor's mansion. What has that been like over the last year, and what do you anticipate happening over the course of this year in that what may be the last year where Republicans do have the supermajority?
Well, much of the relationship between the Republican legislative leadership and the governor has been contentious. I mean, they've certainly been quite public about their acrimony towards each other. I mean, there's been no secrets there. There were also some things that I think the governor and the governor's team and then the Republican leadership worked on together. I mean, there certainly was work that was done together on the House Bill 2 repeal. There was work that has been done together on a lot of economic development topics, including, you know, the opportunity to have a major auto manufacturer try and come and put a plant here. So there's some areas where things kind of have to work together, or there's been some incentive to work together. But really, we won't see the Republicans open to more collaborative decision making until we're able to break the supermajority.
And that was a key initiative from Cooper. I mean, launching the campaign funding that he is the fundraising, I should say, that he personally kind of took over as well, seems to be a big priority from him. What has he been telling Democratic leadership?
Yeah, so North Carolina is actually really ahead of the National Democratic Party in having our act together. There's a lot of news, a lot of coverage about how National Democrats are in disarray and don't know what the message is and who's the leader. And, you know, people are still arguing over last year's presidential primaries. It's been 2 years since the presidential primaries. But here in North Carolina, Governor Cooper launched the Break the Majority effort, which brings the governor's team, the state Democratic Party, and the House and Senate Democratic caucuses all under one umbrella, working towards the same goal of breaking the supermajorities in the legislature. We are all on one team. We are all pushing for the same thing. That, unfortunately, doesn't happen often in Democratic politics. But what it means is that here in North Carolina, we are being very efficient in terms of how we're running our operations, and that's getting us some effectiveness in recruiting candidates, raising money, because everybody sees we know what we're doing, we got a game plan, we know what the governor is fighting for, let's help get the legislature that can help get the governor those things.
Well, you mentioned the trying to work toward what the goals where it's going to require Republicans and Democrats to be on the same page. Anytime something happens like that where there is a kind of a universal win that's perceived, nobody is quick to Philberger and Tim Moore aren't quick to give Roy Cooper a lot of credit and kind of vice versa. And they're not praising each other in any of these things. Not that we have a ton of those really to look at over the past year. And then obviously Roy Cooper would love to have more Democrats at the state level. So is there – how is it what's the best method that in your mind of working together and acknowledging whenever there's a common goal versus also you're trying to get more Democrats elected?
Well, I think we have to elect more Democrats in order to get to that place. Because the supermajority gives the Republicans so much power, there is no real incentive for them to do things that are more collaborative. That their incentive, even when they are working with the governor, their incentive is to bash the governor and bash Democrats to try and hold on to the supermajority that they have. Without a supermajority, either party has to be able to work with the other party. And so you certainly have plenty of room on the playground for battling over partisan issues, but you also have to look for things where you can come together. So one of the things that happened in 2017 that had bipartisan support was the STOP Act, which is an act to take on opioid addiction and deaths in North Carolina. And so that was a great success. Just imagine how much more we could do for treating addiction, mental illness, and plenty of other health issues if we expanded Medicaid in North Carolina and took the federal dollars that are available to us but we're not accessing to do that. The current Republican supermajority is never going to do that. But knowing that Democrats and Republicans are concerned about the opioid crisis in our districts, thinking about what's a North Carolina plan to access those federal Medicaid dollars to bring in some resources to help people who are suffering in our communities, I think we can get to a bipartisan solution on that. But not until we kind of level out the power so that it's more balanced and not so unrepresentative. I mean, that the problem with the supermajority right now is it's not representative of the state. The Republicans have a disproportionate number of seats compared to their percentage of the vote because the districts are gerrymandered.
Yeah, and declared unconstitutional at every level of the court process so far. And, you know, we've been living under these maps for 7, going on 8 years now. So this is the WCHL Community Forum. We've got House Representative Greg Meyer in with us today, and we will be back for more of this conversation on the WCHL Community Forum, 97.9 The Hill.
Get ready to try something new or maybe fulfill a lifelong dream. Sign up for continuing education courses at the Durham or Orange County campuses of Durham Tech. You can explore everything from photography to culinary arts, information technology to healthcare, EMS training to foreign language essentials. And you can take many of the courses in the evening or on the weekend. So go ahead, visit durhamtech.edu and click on continuing education and get ready to do great things.
Chapel Hill is open.
Chapel Hill is open to the arts.
Chapel Hill is open to diversity.
To education.
To collaboration.
To transit.
To foodies.
To innovation.
To progress.
To the environment.
To light rail.
To craft brews.
To affordable housing.
To city parks.
To kids.
To connectivity.
To business.
To culture.
To green.
To smart growth.
Chapel Hill is open to family.
Chapel Hill is open.
Chapel Hill is open to you.
For more information, visit open2.biz.
Welcome back to the WCHL Community Forum, brought to you by the Town of Chapel Hill Economic Development. Chapel Hill is open to education, arts, and culture, and exploring the natural world. We're a diverse place that appreciates our past and looks forward to our future. More at opentobusiness.biz. And by Durham Tech. With many green building features, the state-of-the-art 20-acre Orange County campus of Durham Tech helps Orange County residents do great things as they pursue their education, workforce training, and lifelong learning. Now, back to the WCHL Community Forum.
Welcome back to the WCHL Community Forum, 97.9 The Hill. I'm Blake Hodge alongside Greg Meyer, our local House representative here and recruitment chair for the House Democrats. This is going to be a broad question. It's not going to have a specific answer, so it means it's going to be a really good question to begin this segment. Whenever you're recruiting North Carolina Democrats to run for the House in some districts that even under new maps are not going to be what we have typically seen as Democratic-friendly districts, what does that person, that recruit, I'm going to say look like, but I mean what are the values that they kind of present that are common across the state? Or are there, is it that much of a variance in you versus somebody that is running in a typically more conservative part of the state?
I mean, the two things that I want most out of a candidate is I want them to really have a deep connection with the community that they're going to run to serve, and I want them to be able to communicate their values clearly. And so I think that the first of those means that you do get some variance in ideology, because you know what people care about related to their community and then the way they express it is going to be a little bit different when you're in a major urban area versus a rural area, for instance, or a highly educated area here versus some other areas that are a little bit more working class or impoverished. I mean, that those things do come across as different, and you want somebody who's going to be able to relate to the people that they're running for. And so people are smart. It's hard to convince someone to run for a race that they know is an uphill battle. But there are people who understand that it's important to have the Democratic perspective represented, and that there are victories in a campaign besides actually winning the election. There are things you can do for your community. You can bring pressure to the incumbent to try and get them to work on some things just by running against them. You can help to build up the party infrastructure by running a campaign, and that's important for statewide campaigns and other things. So there's a lot of reasons to run, even if you know you have a long shot of winning, and sometimes people will. There are other times where people, I think, very wisely recognize that running in the community that they're in would have consequences that would be damaging to them and their family, and that given the community leadership roles that they play, they would be better to stay out of politics to be able to be effective in continuing to lead in other civic ways. And when they tell me that, I completely understand.
Have you seen some of those areas that are maybe more typically more rural change at all in your couple of years of being in this type of office? I'm thinking specific. I'm from Alamance County, so you've got Burlington and some other municipalities technically, but Alamance County as a whole has typically been a red county. So how is that changing at all?
Yeah, the areas that are changing the most in North Carolina are the big city suburbs, so certainly Wake and Mecklenburg counties, and then the mid-sized cities. So Burlington and Alamance County is a great example. Rocky Mount, Morganton, Boone, Waynesville, even I think the area around Wilmington, you know, in all of those mid-sized cities, we're seeing that as the population is getting a little bit younger, as there's some economic development work going on in all those areas, that the voting population is starting to lean a little bit more Democratic. In Alamance County in particular, you've got a lot of people who are living on the eastern edge of Alamance County because they commute to Chapel Hill or Durham, but Alamance is a cheaper place to live and they're raising their families there. And so the House district that is on the eastern part of Alamance County, which is House District 63, which is pretty solidly Republican just a couple years ago, is one that is definitely going to be a competitive district in 2018, because the demographics have just been changing.
Yeah, it seems to be just accelerating as well with the pace with which people are moving to North Carolina. It continues to be one of the fastest growing states overall. But then as well, I mean, we're getting a little crowded in some of these places, so you got to move out a little bit. Whenever you're looking at 2018 goals from kind of House Democratic leadership, from an election standpoint, What are those at this point? Have they been kind of curated and brought down?
I mean, the goal is to break the supermajority and try and at least give the governor power to have his veto be upheld. I think that we would like to work towards winning back the majority by 2020, because we want to be able to make sure that we end partisan gerrymandering before the next round of redistricting in 2021. So it's kind of a two-step goal to break the supermajority this time and then break the majority in 2020. If this turns out to be a tidal wave election and we break the majority in 2018, that's great. But then we're going to have to hold a lot of seats in 2020. So either way, we've got two election cycles in front of us that are going to be very critical for our ability to do some good things.
What about legislatively? First off, how big of a challenge is it to be part of the effort to get candidates statewide and get everybody ready to run a good campaign and also do your job as the representative for this community?
You definitely have to juggle those things, as well as juggling family and career, you know, all of that. I personally have put a lot of time into the recruitment aspect because to be able to lead on the issues that I care about and I think this community cares about, education, healthcare, affordability, to be able to lead on those issues, we need more Democrats. We need a Democratic majority. And so I put a lot of time into the political to try to get us there so that we can make better policy. But in the short run, where we don't have a Democratic majority, I'm still looking at things that I can work on in 2018 where I think there's some bipartisan agreement. In 2017, two bills that I worked on that made it out of the House and are in the Senate now. One was a bill to support local law enforcement agencies and being able to work together more easily when they have to do things that cross jurisdictional lines. That was something that Sheriff Charles Blackwood asked me to work on, and I worked with some Republicans on that. And then I've been working on rural broadband access. And that's an issue that cuts across a lot of communities represented by both Democrats and Republicans. And so Representative John Zoka, who's a Republican from Cumberland County, has been the lead on a bill called the Bright Futures Act that would make a little bit of rural broadband expansion possible. And so I've been working with him on trying to build some support for that. But those two issues of the bills are in the Senate, and we've got to try and get the Senate to carry those through. And if I was able to get those two things done, I would feel like that was a couple of good accomplishments for my community. You know, people here in Orange, in southern Orange County, where WCHL is, we don't have problem getting rural broadband access down here. But when you drive up to Caldwell, Cedar Grove, mm-hmm. the areas of my district that are to the north end of the county, that is the number one thing that people complain to me about.
And we've seen that kind of get taken on at the county level, with the commissioners have, you know, an RFP out right now trying to work on some of that, but also just community members, whether it be trying to run a small business or whatever they're trying to do, just, you know, be part of 2018. It's hard to fathom just not having easy internet access for someone that comes into work, and then you go back to your home that has that high speed access. So can you put that into like anecdotally, as you're talking with them, how is that impacting their life on a day-to-day basis? And why, you know, you mentioned the STOP Act last year. So this is clearly an area that, you know, we've got a lot of rural parts of North Carolina represented by Republicans. So what has been the holdup so far?
I don't know why Republicans have been so slow to act on rural broadband. It seems to me like it's an easy victory for whoever takes the lead on it, and I'm happy to share that victory across party lines because it's good for people. You know, the ways that it comes up, you hear about people complaining their kids can't do their homework and things like that, and then you hear about people whose businesses are hampered. What I don't think you hear enough of is that, you know, the problems we have in rural North Carolina is that we have problem with growing businesses, and we have problem with brain drain, with people leaving rural North Carolina for urban North Carolina. Expanding broadband to rural North Carolina would be the number one thing you could do to address both of those two things. If you can get high-speed internet access, people are be better able to build and sustain businesses in rural communities, could be able to access the world economy. People could work in from home but live in a rural area. So now you have people who leave the rural area just because they have to go to a bigger area for their ability to work. But, you know, the brain drain could stop if we just gave people a way to stay in their community but still work for multinational corporations or even North Carolina small businesses, but that have people spread out wherever they are. So I feel like the investment of making a better policy infrastructure and putting some money into expanding rural broadband is probably the most important economic development tool that we could do across the state.
And on that economic development note, that's, you know, jobs is always the a campaign message that people are, you know, bringing jobs here to the state as a whole, to this local community. North Carolina just missed out on the Toyota Mazda plant in one of the four, I believe it is, mega sites across the state. From that type of engine of the economy and everything that's going on in North Carolina, from some of that movement, what areas have you seen maybe beyond this, what we've talked about so far, that are there that can be moved on now with some bipartisanship?
I think there's certainly bipartisan interest in rural economic development. The challenge is there's no easy statewide plan, and so much of what you talk about is based on regional plans. So sometimes that regional plan looks like, you know, there's some economic development going on in downtown Rocky Mountain, so what spins off of something that's happening in the city? Sometimes it's off of a major project like a megasite project where you're building one giant thing that attracts a lot of stuff to it. What we don't have as good of is we don't have as good of a vision or apparatus for how to help small businesses grow, in part because of infrastructure limitations like broadband access. And so we have to do a lot of creative thinking about how do you help small local economies grow based on whatever it is that they're good at. One thing that I've been trying to push is, as a former tobacco state, we could really be on the forefront of industrial hemp production. Hemp ends up getting used for everything from creating fabrics and paper to medicines and fuel. And we have plenty of land that would be good for growing hemp, plenty of farmers who need a decent cash crop. Mm-hmm. The problem that we have in the state is that hemp is very expensive to produce. And so if you have to ship it a long way and then get it produced, it starts to become a not very profitable product. So can we get some production facilities built in North Carolina that would help farmers get their product to market? Hemp is an expensive thing to produce in part because it requires a lot of energy. So can we connect the production of that to the implementation of solar and wind energy so that rural economies are really getting built from the assets they have, the land they have, the air and the sunshine that they have, and they can have a product that they can export and all the money comes back to their community? That's the type of thing that I think we have to have in order to help the parts of North Carolina that are left behind have a way of catching up.
One more economic development note, and then we'll take a break and move on to get to another segment here on the WCHL Community Forum. North Carolina was in the running for the Toyota Mazda plant, and you know, it seems like it's been several car dealership things in the past couple of years, going to South Carolina, Tennessee, Georgia, now Alabama with this one. But it seems like North Carolina is also getting in the running for a lot of other types of projects that are not that type of kind of manufacturing facility. Amazon being one, looking for their second headquarters, or Apple and UNC are working very closely on a lot of projects. GSK and UNC and Duke and NC State launching all of these different types of companies. How is the North Carolina economy evolving on, you know, the research being done here and attracting these new tech companies, and how is that going to be capitalized on?
Well, we've had a long history of having economic growth based on having a very well-educated workforce and low cost of living and great quality of life. Those things, to keep those things in place, number one, we have to continue to have strong education. And so that's always been my number one top issue, and I'm concerned about the challenges that our public schools and universities are struggling with right now. I think we've underinvested in those areas where traditionally they had been our strengths. I don't think we're doing nearly enough in early childhood education to build a foundation for our children. So I feel like that we have to do a lot of. On the affordability and quality of life, our quality of life continues to be great. So what can we do about affordability? We know there's talk here in Chapel Hill, as well as in most major urban areas of the state, about affordability of housing. I think that those are issues that local elected officials and officials at my level need to collaborate on. But there are a lot of areas of the state where there can be great growth and are still quite affordable. We were just talking about Burlington, Alamance County a moment ago. There's certainly areas in both the east and the west and the Piedmont where I think we'd like to see some investment go from larger corporations that need a facility. So, you know, for instance, we have Apple has a couple large server farms where they're in rural communities, mm-hmm. employing a couple hundred people. It's not, you know,
which is a big deal.
Not thousands, but in that community, a couple hundred jobs is a big deal, especially when they pay that level of wages. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's why our economic development professionals continue to try to find piecemeal approaches for those types of things, even when that's not the giant plant like the Toyota Mazda deal was going to be.
This is the WCHL Community Forum on 97.9 The Hill, a conversation with House Representative Greg Meyer, and we'll continue on after this.
Chapel Hill is open.
Chapel Hill is open to the arts.
Chapel Hill is open to diversity.
To education.
To collaboration.
To transit.
To foodies.
To innovation.
To progress.
To the environment.
To light rail.
To craft brews.
To affordable housing.
To city parks.
To kids.
To connectivity.
To business.
To culture.
To green.
To smart growth.
Chapel Hill is open to family.
Chapel Hill is open.
Chapel Hill is open to you.
For more information, visit open2.biz.
The Orange County campus of Durham Tech is booming with 70% more course offerings. This is Penny Gluck, Executive Dean of Durham Tech's Orange County campus, here to invite you to find out why your neighbors and their kids are being educated by us in careers for the 21st century. We specialize in healthcare careers, including emergency medical management, computers, the arts, and much more. To see the full catalog, go to durhamtech.edu. I'll look forward to seeing you on campus here in Orange County.
Welcome back to the WCHL Community Forum, brought to you by the Town of Chapel Hill Economic Development. Chapel Hill is open to education, arts, and culture, and exploring the natural world. We're a diverse place that appreciates our past and looks forward to our future. More at opentobusiness.biz. And by Durham Tech. With many green building features, the state-of-the-art 20-acre Orange County campus of Durham Tech helps Orange County residents do great things as they pursue their education, workforce training, and lifelong learning. Now, back to the WCHL Community Forum.
The WCHL Community Forum, 97.9 The Hill, for the month of January, flipping over to 2018 now, and it feels like we've been talking about elections nonstop since the last one, but we've got another one coming up this fall, the Blue Moon election, as you mentioned, which is really going to be interesting. We were talking with Michael Bitzer from Catawba College, a well-known political scientist, about the changing demographics in North Carolina and some of the voter data that he was looking at. Now, independents outnumbering Republicans in the state, but not necessarily meaning that they are independently minded in all cases. So whenever you're looking at 2018 as a whole, Representative Meyer here, is that presenting a challenge by any means of people aligning themselves as an independent, but based on the way that people have tended to vote, it may sound better to be independent than to actually vote?
Yeah, I think the consensus is that people are identifying themselves as independent because they're not entirely happy with either political party, which makes sense, because when you only have two things to choose between, there are lots of people who feel like I'm not completely aligned with one or the other. But those people, those independents, do tend to be either more liberal or more conservative, tend to vote more Democrat or more Republican. And there's lots of ways to use data to figure out which way they tend to lean. I think that the Democratic Party needs to continue to figure out how to unify its message so that we can draw some of those people back to us and maybe even some people over to us, and certainly not to use messages that push people away.
Well, one thing that is consistently been a Democratic talking point message is educational funding. At the local level, you know, we keep hearing about the strains that lack of state funding is putting on local schools. Charter schools are rising at a quick rate. You've got school choice or whatever words you want to use there, the taxpayer money that's being allocated to scholarships that can be then used at private schools. And all of this, depending on if you're talking to you or Phil Berger, you're going to get very different answers, of course. So is there a path to come back to get on the same page? Probably breaking the supermajority being the first part of that again, but to move forward to getting back to its roots, kind of in a North Carolina sense of funding education at a level that is sufficient.
I think I'm very disappointed by how partisan education has become. That wasn't how we built the greatness of the state. I think that education can be something with a lot of bipartisan agreement. And there are times in the North Carolina House where we have a lot of agreement on education issues across parties. In some ways, the biggest disputes in the legislature about education policy have been between the House and the Senate, not between parties. The Democrats and Republicans in the House have lined up together a few times to try and push against the Senate, and the Senate Republicans have their own mind and create a lot of wedge issues around education. So I think there has to be a change in the balance of power in the Senate before we're really going to see a dramatic change in the way that education funding and policy is taken on. I believe that if we had a more balanced legislature, we would find some ways to work together on education while still having plenty of things that we would disagree upon. But in order to just move that baseline number of the amount that we're spending on educating children, in order to move that number up, that's only going to happen with a change in political control in Raleigh.
And we hear different talking points from each party. So whenever
people come out and say education funding is at an extreme low in North Carolina. And then you hear the Republican response of being, we've raised teacher pay, we're doing this, the funding levels are at the highest they've been. What's the rub there?
Well, it's a question of statistics and how you measure them, what statistics you're reporting. The absolute dollar amount being spent has gone up, but the dollar amount per pupil or the dollar amount per citizen has not kept up with the rate of inflation. It's not, we're not at the level that we were at before the 2008 economic crash. And so I think that there's some real legitimate reasons to feel like our commitment to education is not now where it was 10 years ago.
One thing that has been a key to this gerrymandering discussion, kind of wrapping up with where we started, was redistricting and who is doing that redistricting. We, you know, there are other states that have taken on independent redistricting commissions. Iowa being one of those. California put it on the ballot a couple of years ago to let voters decide if they wanted to change the way that lines were drawn and all these types of things. California and Iowa are very different in terms of thinking and population and demographics and all that stuff. And North Carolina may be kind of in the middle of each of those. So is there – if there is that tsunami, if you want to call that, and Democrats are able to take the House as a whole – I know that's a hypothetical and we don't like to deal in hypotheticals, but how high on the priority list is an independent redistricting commission for North Carolina Democrats?
If North Carolina Democrats took over the House of Representatives after the 2018 elections, I believe that House Bill 1 in next year's session would be an independent redistricting bill. I think that is our number one top priority because we believe it's so fundamental towards restoring small-d democracy to the state of North Carolina.
And Ellie Kinnaird for a long time was the Democrat that would sign up to co-sponsor the independent redistricting legislation when Democrats were in power, and it would go about as far as it's gone the last few years with Republicans in power of trying to get that done. Is the breaking the supermajority enough for movement on this, or is it going to have to be a total flipping of one chamber?
I think that it's much more likely with flipping one or both chambers. It's possible if we broke the supermajority in both chambers and the Republican majorities felt like they were at risk of losing their majorities in 2020, that they would get to work on a compromise deal on redistricting just to try and take the safe path forward before the 2021 redistricting happens. But that seems like it's kind of iffy. What I can commit to is that the Democrats in the legislature now almost universally have publicly committed ourselves to redistricting reform. We know that Democrats use gerrymandering to our party's advantage, but most of us weren't there when that happened. And the veterans that are there now and were there when that happened in the past have recognized the ways at which that hurts our democracy. And I think everyone's committed towards moving to an independent process.
Do you think that that is going to – is it a better chance maybe that this comes from a federal level and kind of trickles down from either a court ruling, or I know that David Price, our local congressman, has introduced a bill that would create these redistricting commissions for every state? Is it going – I mean
– Well, I think if the Supreme Court rules in the cases that it's currently hearing on partisan redistricting, including the North Carolina case, if the Supreme Court rules against partisan redistricting, partisan gerrymandering, I think that will be a lot of pressure on states to come up with an independent process. Because the easiest way to avoid future legal battles on partisan redistricting is going to be to set up an independent process where nobody can sue one party or the other for having tried to rig the maps.
Yeah, that's the weird thing that we're going into the 2018 election. We're still fighting over 2011 maps. So I think everybody would be a lot better, can agree we'd be a lot better if we weren't having this continuous kind of infighting over this. So
yep.
Looking at 2018 as a whole moving forward, what else is on your agenda?
Well, the other big thing for people to watch is the Republicans' continued efforts to overhaul the judiciary, and most of that has been in pretty damaging ways, I think. They've already made all judicial elections partisan when they were previously nonpartisan. They eliminated some judicial primaries, which makes for a much more crowded field in the on the general election that's quite confusing to voters. They're working on a redistricting plan, which would dramatically change the way that judicial seats are apportioned across the state. And that is clearly designed to give them partisan benefit in the number of judges that they have who on the bench who are Republicans. So there's a lot happening. It's fairly difficult to follow all the pieces that are moving in the Republican attack on the judiciary, but I think that is the thing that informed citizens need to pay the most attention to, because without a well-functioning and fully independent judiciary, our democracy really starts to fall apart at the seams. That's core to who we are. And one particular thing I didn't mention, that there's still a plan that's floating out there where the Republicans would run a constitutional amendment that would take away the ability to vote for judges altogether. Yep. And go to some type of selection process. I'm a fan of voting for judges. I know that sometimes it's hard to know who is this judge and what are you voting for, but I would rather have citizens pick judges who then rule on the laws created by legislators. I'd rather have that than having legislators pick judges who rule on the laws that we pass.
Judge, that's always a big question of do voters know enough about a candidate? Specifically, you know, as much as you think of people as being independent, and of course, judges in almost all cases are that independent, unwavering kind of figure. But now that we've put the R's and D's on there, people are so quick to kind of fall in line with some of those affiliations. Does that present a concern for? I mean, is that still a better option? It sounds like in your mind than revamping this in some way.
I think that having judges elected gives people a sense that they own the court system, and the court system should be owned by people. It shouldn't be controlled by politicians. I think that the switch to partisan elections was done so that Republicans could give voters an easy identifier of which side you should pick, and most judges don't think about themselves as being on a side. Even if they are a registered member of a political party, the political party doesn't dictate how they interpret the law. They do have some sense of morality and perspective that certainly can be more attached to one party or another, but I think voters are able to kind of figure out, like, does this person really understand my community? Do they reflect our values? Would I want them sitting on the bench if I had a case that came in front of them and I'm going to be tried in a courtroom that should have a jury of my peers and a judge who understands what the social context of where I live is? Is that the person that I would want up there? And I think voters, if they feel like they can figure that out and vote for that person, that's a much more important criteria than what political party they're registered with.
Greg Meyer is our one of the local House representatives in Orange County, Verlansco, and Senator Valerie Fucci as well, representing the community in Raleigh. And we appreciate Greg stopping by to participate in the WCHL Community Forum.
Thank you for having me, Blake. Great to talk with you.
We'll be back to wrap up the WCHL Community Forum after this.
Get ready to try something new or maybe fulfill a lifelong dream. Sign up for continuing education courses at the Durham or Orange County campuses of Durham Tech. You can explore everything from photography to culinary arts, information technology to healthcare, EMS training to foreign language essentials. And you can take many of the courses in the evening or on the weekend. So go ahead, visit durhamtech.edu and click on continuing education and get ready to do great things.
Chapel Hill is open Chapel Hill is open to the arts.
Chapel Hill is open to diversity.
To education.
To collaboration.
To transit.
To foodies.
To innovation.
To progress.
To the environment.
To light rail.
To craft brews.
To affordable housing.
To city parks.
To kids.
To connectivity.
To business.
To culture.
To green.
To smart growth.
Chapel Hill is open to family.
Chapel Hill is open.
Chapel Hill is open to you.
For more information, visit open2.biz.
Welcome back to the WCHL Community Forum, brought to you by the Town of Chapel Hill Economic Development. Chapel Hill is open to education, arts, and culture, and exploring the natural world. We're a diverse place that appreciates our past and looks forward to our future. More at opentobusiness.biz. And by Durham Tech. With many green building features, the state-of-the-art 20-acre Orange County campus of Durham Tech helps Orange County residents do great things as they pursue their education, workforce training, and lifelong learning. Now, back to the WCHL Community Forum.
Welcome back into the WCHL Community Forum here on 97.9 The Hill. I'm Blake Hodge. A big thank you once again to House Representative Greg Meyer, along with Verla Insko in the House, and Senator Valerie Fouché representing our community in Raleigh at the State General Assembly. And you can get a lot more from all of them by visiting our website, chapelboro.com. Coming up throughout the rest of 2018, we expect to bring you a lot of great community forum conversations, these hour-long discussions about the issues of the day throughout our community. But putting a bow on some of the conversation we had with Greg Meyer this hour, talking about elections coming up throughout the 2018 cycle. We will have the primaries this spring, where we will be voting for Orange County commissioners in particular as well. There is still the election in the fall typically, but most of the time Democrats winning those seats. So we'll keep a look on the primary races for Orange County commissioners, and then judicial races that are going to be on the ballot. But you're guaranteed to have the local elections with county commissioners, and then the state level races as well, with the House and Senate both being reelected for another term and then heading back to Raleigh for 2018. And of course, we'll be tracking that to see how the 2018 election is going to impact the makeup of the General Assembly in 2019. It could really change the nature of the General Assembly, with just a few seats going toward the Democratic Party in the House in particular, to be able to break that supermajority of the General Assembly Republicans at the moment. You can head over to our website, chapelboro.com, if you missed out on any of the community forum from today, or else if you want to catch up on past community forum conversations, they're all housed there as well. This is the WCHL Community Forum on 97.9 The Hill. I'm Blake Hodge. A big thank you once again to local House Representative Greg Meyer for stopping in and spending some time with us here for the January 2018 WCHL Community Forum, all on 97.9 The Hill.
This month's WCHL Community Forum was presented by the Town of Chapel Hill Economic Development. Its mission is to support opportunities to put Chapel Hill's people to work and create economic prosperity for all, now and in the future. More at opentobusiness.biz. And by Durham Tech. $500 scholarships are now available at Durham Tech for any Chapel Hill, Carrboro, or Orange County High School resident who graduated from their local high school in the past year. So go to durhamtech.edu and type Connect Funds into the search box and get ready to do great things.
Chapel Hill is open.
Chapel Hill is open to the arts.
Chapel Hill is open to diversity.
To education.
To collaboration.
To transit.
To foodies.
To innovation.
To progress.
To the environment.
To light rail.
To craft brews.
To affordable housing.
To city parks.
To kids.
To connectivity.
To business.
To culture.
To green.
To smart growth.
Chapel Hill is open to family.
Chapel Hill is open.
Chapel Hill is open to you.
For more information, visit opentoo.biz.
The Orange County campus of Durham Tech is booming with 70% more course offerings. This is Penny Gluck, Executive Dean of Durham Tech's Orange County campus, here to invite you to find out why your neighbors and their kids are being educated by us in careers for the 21st century. We specialize in healthcare careers, including emergency medical management, computers, the arts, and much more. To see the full catalog, go to durhamtech.edu. I look forward to seeing you on campus here in Orange County.